Hi, this is Jen Rubin, and this is Jen Rubin's Green Room. We're recording this the day before, the first presidential debate, maybe the only presidential debate between Vice President Kamala Harris and felon and former President Donald Trump. Well, a few things have happened before the debate that we should review, but I also want to focus on how the debate is being set up, being covered, being positioned by the media. The most important pre-debate event, I think, is the very robust endorsement of both Dick Cheney and Liz Cheney for Kamala Harris. And what Liz Cheney in particular said was, you can't play this game of saying, I don't like Trump, but I'm not going to vote for Kamala Harris. There is a binary choice. You're either for one or you're for the other. You either believe that Trump is a menace to our democracy, to the rule of law, to decency, to our national security, or you don't. And in doing that, I think she stripped away the really mealy-mouthed, spineless excuses of a lot of Republicans, both elected Republicans, former electeds like Nikki Haley, and a whole slew of pundits who are forever making excuses why they cannot endorse Kamala Harris. Well, she hasn't given enough detail on her housing proposal, you see. This is nonsense. All you need to know is one guy cannot be trusted with power, tried to subvert the election, wants to use violence against his political opponent, and the other doesn't. But Liz Cheney said something else that I thought was very important, and I wish those Republicans would listen to. And what she said was that there is an affirmative case for her as commander-in-chief to defend national security. She came right out and said it. She said that she understands we're an exceptional nation. Kamala Harris understands the importance of alliances. Kamala Harris respects the military. So she wasn't simply saying not Trump. She was giving a pretty full-throated endorsement of Harris herself. And aside from political cowardice and just imbued in deeply entrenched partisan tribalism, there is no reason not to endorse Kamala Harris if you understand that Trump is what Trump is. Now, you, of course, have the pre-debate polls, which are now beginning to dribble out. There's one from Pew. There's one from the New York Times. And I will say this. I find the whole poll game utterly distasteful. Imagine we're in Germany in 1933. Would it be appropriate to be covering the polls? Or would you be covering Mein Kampf and the rise of the Nazi threat? The effort to divert this to polling, to process, to the never-ending search for some policy position that Donald Trump has is a dodge. It's a way of avoiding the central issue, which is one candidate is in favor of democracy and the other isn't. One candidate is sane and the other isn't. And so all of this jabber about polls, all of this reinterpretation of Trump so he sounds more sane than he actually is really another distressing sign of the media's failure. Now, we are going to have the debate on Tuesday night, and it's going to be really interesting to see what ABC does. Do they play the same game as CNN, where they're essentially nothing more than timekeepers? They don't comment on the gusher of lies coming out of Trump. They never ask a question with embedded facts, such as, why did you claim that you had won the election when there is no evidence that that was true? Those are ways you fact check before he says something. In other words, you put him in the frame of reality. Are they going to do that? CNN surely didn't. Are they going to ask him some hard questions like, why have you proposed a fascist plan to lock up your opponents, to lock up their lawyers, and promised a bloody process for rounding up millions upon millions of illegal immigrants? Those sorts of questions absolutely have to be asked, and they never have been asked. CNN doesn't ask them, and you can just bet your bottom dollar that the ABC folks will say, well, we couldn't ask everything. We had to ask him what his position on education was. We had to ask him what his position on trade was. No, you don't. When a fascist is standing in front of you, spewing lies, threatening to tear out the Constitution by the roots, that is the issue that matters. And everything else is a dodge. Everything else is an attempt to treat him like a normal candidate, which he absolutely is not. So I do have my qualms about the upcoming debate, but I will say this. Kamala Harris is not Joe Biden. And in some radio interviews she did on Monday, today, she made it clear that she's fully prepared for Trump to lie nonstop, that there is no bottom for him. So she is clearly prepared to deflect, to fact check if need be, and to state her own position. Now, one of the other habits of the media is to frame everything as a test for her. She has to prove herself. She has to define herself. She has to fill in the blank. Why is it always a test for her? Why doesn't he have to prove he's sane? But again, this is the media framing because they're so invested in the notion that this should be an ordinary race with a candidate on one side who believes certain things and a candidate on the other. And that's why they make up these policy positions for Trump, which he promptly renounces at the drop of a hat. In favor of an abortion ban, in favor of restricting access to contraception. Oh no, he's going to be the president in favor of reproductive rights. This is nonsense. And it just goes to his utter moral depravity and his lack of interest in anything other than himself. So we are going to have quite the debate, and the post-debate wrangling, I'm sure, is going to be something like we've never seen. Whatever she does will not be good enough. Whatever she does will not be sufficient. There will be people who still have doubts. There will be people who want to know more about her housing policy, about her education policy. Enough already. The media's job is to explain what is in front of them. And what is in front of them is a fascist and an unhinged, unwell man attempting to destroy her democracy. That's it. That's all they have to do. But I don't think they're capable of doing it. And my media friends say, oh, don't prejudge them. Give them a shot. Maybe they'll do it. Don't get your hopes up. And I have to say, I have some confidence that Kamala Harris knows that the debate moderators are not going to do that. She's going to have to do that. So where does all of this leave us? I think it leaves us kind of where we've been all along, which is there is a very entrenched segment of American voters who are buried deep in the bubble of right-wing media, who like the cruelty, like the racism, like the xenophobia that Trump offers. And there is a slightly larger contingent of Americans who revile those things. And the question is going to come down, yes, to turnout. Who's going to show up? What kind of organization do the two sides have to actually get their people to the polls? And are there enough sane, middle-of-the-roadish, moderate Republicans who say, okay, enough. Whatever tax plan she has, whatever budget plan she has, it cannot possibly be as bad as reelecting Donald Trump. I don't know how it's going to come out. I think she has the advantage, but not by a lot. And of course, there are the Senate races and the House races as well. Now, I want to talk about one other poll that I actually do put a lot of faith in and is quite disturbing. The Public Religion Research Institute will be out with a poll in the next day or so. And that will look at the views of Republicans and Christian nationalists. And it's going to tell a very frightful story. It's going to tell a story that these people are very much wedded to an authoritarian outlook on society, that their hierarchical, their male-dominated religion also affects their political views, that they are not pro-democracy. They are in favor of a strong man. They want someone to tell them what to do and to tell everyone else what to do. And the reason this is so disturbing is that once this becomes literally an article of faith, you can't just reason people away from it. You can't simply educate them about the Constitution. It's something so ingrained in them and so emotional that they will not give it up. We're talking about the religious wars of Europe in the Middle Ages, when people are so fixated on their own version of reality that you really cannot reason with them. And what does that portend? Well, that means the rest of us have to get out and vote. It means we shouldn't expend too much effort on trying to persuade the unpersuadables. Maybe there are still some. Maybe there are people who aren't particularly tuned in to politics, who, if given a little bit more information, will figure it out and come to the right decision. But trying to reason with the rest of them, trying to show them respect because they feel so aggrieved, that's nonsense. They think this is religious doctrine. And it has always been such. My next program is going to look at that issue with Robert P. Jones, who is the head of the PRRI, and he's an expert on the topic. And you know what? Nothing has changed since before the Civil War. These same religious sects with the same view of society, of male domination, of racial domination, were the same people who supported the Confederacy. And they do to this day. That's why when you saw the mob descending on the Capitol, they were waving Confederate flags. That's why they venerate Confederate soldiers, because nothing much has changed at all. There is a very large segment of less well-educated, less financially secure, white Christian nationalists, and they don't accept the basic premise of American democracy, which is religion and race do not define America. The Constitution does. We have freedom of religion. We do not have religious tests in this country. But a lot of people don't believe that. And I think the quicker we come to terms with that, and the quicker we recognize how dangerous and how defiant they are, I think the more we will turn our attention to reaching everyone else, reaching the young voters who don't always turn out, reaching people who aren't invested in politics, because that's the only way we're going to save democracy. Otherwise, we're going to lose. We're going to lose it all. We're going to lose the rule of law. We're going to lose the Constitution. And we're going to lose the election. But that needn't be the case. You know what to do. Get out and volunteer. Get out and vote. Spend your money wisely in supporting candidates and causes. And remember, only about, I don't know, less than 60 days until election time. Get to work. We are about 8 weeks from the election. We are finally in the home stretch. And issues of race, of gender, of the definition of America have never been more important. And we are really looking at two candidates who have completely different versions of America. One essentially wants to restore the Confederacy, a regime in which white people are on top, authoritarianism is the byword, and Christianity is the official doctrine of the country. And we have another one that is, for lack of a better term, about 21st century America, about a pluralistic, free, tolerant society in which we define ourselves not by religion or race, but by this kind of nebulous idea of the American dream, the American experiment. Well, when I get to thinking about these questions, there is one person that I always go to because he helps put this in perspective historically, but he also underscores that what we have going on is not just a political problem and not just a need for political reform, but we have a religious issue that when it aligns itself with one political party, creates a really big problem. In past decades and past centuries, there could be people of different religions scattered throughout the political structure. So politics wasn't about fulfilling your religious ambitions, your religious identity. When it does become that, then it comes to be a matter of life and death. Then it's something worth using violence to obtain. And that's kind of where we are right now. So the person to talk to us about that is Robert P. Jones. He is the CEO of PRRI, which is the Public Religion Research Institute. They provide a wealth of data on politics, on religion, on American values, and they are out with a new survey, 5,000 people. This is no piddly little survey, which looks at some really important issues about religion, about race, about Christian doctrine. And we're going to talk to him about that and find out what that tells us about the election and tells us about America. And we're also fortunate because this program comes on the very day that the paperback edition of his last book, The Hidden Roots of White Supremacy, is coming out. That book is really a travelogue and a tutorial on efforts at racial reconciliation around the country. And it's a phenomenal book. We're going to talk to him about all of that. So I am delighted to have with us, and particularly now, Robert P. Jones from PRRI. Welcome to the show, Robert.
Hi, glad to be here.
It is delightful to be here. And the last time we talked, I think, was right around the time that the hardcover version of your latest book, The Hidden Roots of White Supremacy, came out. And now we're talking to you when the paperback version is coming out. Are there new parts, new observations, any updates in this version that we didn't enjoy when we got the hardback?
Yes. One of the luxuries of kind of having paperback come out is that you get to kind of have the year and you get a little opportunity at the end to put a new afterword in. So I've got a new afterword looking ahead to the 2024 election here. And, you know, one of the things I did is I looked what's really driving, you know, that connection between Trump and his base supporters. And we, you know, we've had some recent news cycle things that really point us to some things that have had people scratching their heads about his statements on abortion and his flip-flopping on the Florida referendum and, you know, his taking the Republican Party away from actually being an anti-abortion party and from supporting a national ban. And what's going on there? Right. And so what I did in the afterword was to say, well, look, we shouldn't be that surprised in many ways, because if we look at the bigger picture, it has never really been primarily about abortion, even among white evangelical Protestant voters who are at the core of his base. And so what I did is I took advantage of some new data that we actually have from PRRI. Okay. And that is state level data. So not just national data, but 20,000 interviews that we did that gave us a look at support for Christian nationalism in all 50 states. And there's a remarkable chart, you know, in the new afterword that shows this nearly perfect correlation between support for Christian nationalism among white voters all the way at the state level and support for Trump and the last election. And, you know, if you were writing a statistical textbook, and you were a little scatter plot, and I plotted each state. X-axis is how high they scored on Christian nationalism. Y-axis, how much that state voted for Trump among white voters. It is a nearly perfect correlation, like a 45-degree angle trend line through that very tight cluster of the states. And it's just so clear that if you're asking, like, what is the glue, right, that actually bonds Trump to his white evangelical voter base? It really hasn't been abortion. That's why you're not seeing any attrition in support for him here. But they are bonded to him by this vision of restoring their place and their power and this vision of a white Christian America.
What do they want? They say they want a Christian nation. They say they want their values. What does that really entail, though? Christianity is flourishing in America like it is nowhere else on the planet, with perhaps the exception of some poorer developing countries. What more do they want?
Well, I think this is where, when I talk about Christian nationalism, I usually put one more word on the front of it, and that is white Christian nationalism. And it is really about an ethno-religious version of the country, right? So it's always been that, actually, in American history. If we look back, even, things that we talk about normally as white supremacy, like the KKK, right? That group wasn't just anti-black. That group, as you know, right, was also anti-Catholic, and it was anti-Jewish. And what was behind that is this positive vision of a white Anglo-Saxon Protestant Christian version of the country. And so they really want a restoration of that dominance in society in terms of numbers, in terms of political power. That's really what they're out to restore. And, they're working against, I think why we're seeing this resurge, here is because the numbers really aren't in their favor. If you look at white Christians in the country, they've declined. Turn of the 20th century, the country was still a majority white Christian country. Today, that number is 41%, right? If you take all white Christians together. And so I think it's that slide and that sense of power. And if you hear Donald Trump talking to particularly white evangelical audiences, he'll say it straight out, right? He'll say, we're going to bring back our religion. Like, that's the kind of words that he uses. Now, we'll all wince at the word our there because he doesn't quite qualify in the way that most would think someone trying to make a statement like that would. But nevertheless, that's the appeal, right, is that he's trying to restore, not just this vision, but that's why the anti-immigrant piece is so strong here with him, because it is about, like, who are the real Americans? Who really counts? Who is this country of, by, and for? And the answer there is white Christians.
And this talk about the decline of America. Everything is terrible. Western civilization is blowing up. That's very much different than the language you used to hear from Republicans, which was mourning in America. America is an exceptional country. America is the greatest country on the planet. Why that flip, and how does that coexist with this search for a white Christian theocracy, essentially?
Yeah, well, I think he's speaking to something that they feel, right? So one of the things we know is that particularly, there's no group, you wouldn't know this from the kind of political scene, but there's no group that has lost more members than white evangelical Protestants over the last 20 years. They have the steepest decline, right? All white Christian groups are declining, but the steepest one are white evangelicals. And so what they see, even if they don't like look at the statistics, they do know that their children and their grandchildren are not going to those churches that they, thought were the pillars of society. And so I think there's this sense of loss, of grievance, of nostalgia for this kind of 1950s white Christian America that Trump is appealing to. So it's in the water, right, that he in that base audience. And so he's stoking that sense of grievance and fear and a changing America. And again, the anti-immigrant rhetoric is all part of this, right? So how is the country changing, and what's dangerous about the way it's changing? And these language about, he gives it away in the language of, if you don't vote for me, right? He was saying this before, he's back on the campaign trail again, you're not gonna have a country anymore. Now, what does that mean, right? Of course we're gonna have a country, when you think of who he's talking to, you're not going to have the country where you white evangelicals and conservative white Christians are the numeric majority, the political majority, and the cultural majority.
Now, one of the things that deeply disturbs me, and we're going to get to that because you have a new phenomenal survey that's going to be released, is there's no satisfying them. We can't give them what they want because that's unconstitutional. It's contrary to the vision on which this country was founded. We don't have a all-powerful executive. We don't have a state-sponsored religion. So how do they and the rest of us ever come to terms? Is it just a matter of continuing to outvote them? Or is there some kind of religious reformation that's possible in order to bring them back within the tradition of a pluralistic American democracy?
It's a great question. I think that this is kind of what's at the heart, actually, of the book, is I tried to go back and say, well, where's the struggle that we're seeing today? How far back does it go? What forms does it take? And, you know, we have always had this unanswered question. We've never fully answered this in the country of, are we a pluralistic democracy where everybody stands on equal footing, regardless of race or religion, or are we a kind of promised land for European Christians, right? Where that's who the country's for. That's who it was deemed, you know, go in and possess the land, like all those biblical, you know, images that a new Zion, like the promised land. And I think that we're still struggling with this, right? We've struggled with it through our entire country's existence. That question was with us before the founding of the Republic. You can see those contradictions even in the Declaration of Independence that we're about to celebrate the 250th year anniversary next year, and even in the Constitution, where Indians are excluded, you know, African Americans are counted as 3/5 of a person, and then only to enhance the power of slave owners. So you could see us wrestling with that, and it's still here. And I think what we're seeing, though, is that it has sharpened because of the demographic changes in the country, and it's no longer a theoretical question, right? But it's really a question right now, here and now, about power and who the country really is for. And so it's a quest, really, there's no other way to say it. It's an authoritarian quest for minority rule. Yes. That's really what's on the table now. And so I don't think there is any appeasing this group. I mean, it's an anti-democratic, authoritarian, and really, you know, at least pseudo-fascist, you know, movement in the country. And it just has to be really resisted and hopefully pulling, you know, so it's not, there's not really a possibility to compromise with that worldview, but hopefully there is some, you know, efforts at persuasion that might be. But it really has to be, no, actually, here's the democratic vision, a pluralistic democratic vision of the country. And that's what we have to kind of really fight for and help, you know, people get on board with.
And now their worst nightmare has come true, because who is Donald Trump up against but a woman of color, which is just apocalyptic, I'm sure, in their worldview, that, like, what does the country come from? We had one Black president, and now we're going to have another one who's also Asian American and who's now a woman. You know, you can understand the freak out from those people who think that white males should always dominate society. Now, you do have a new survey out from PRRI, which really gets to something we've talked about indirectly, which is the overlap between authoritarianism, Christian nationalism, and the Republican Party. Talk to us a little bit about that, and maybe we should start with how we measure an inclination or a sort of sympathy towards authoritarianism.
Well, that's a great place to start. So, yes, we have a survey released on September 10th, and it is our attempt to really try to measure something that's hard to measure. That is authoritarianism. Luckily, we have you know, a long history in political science and the social sciences of people testing out ways to measure this, and we've actually learned from that and kind of taken some of the best measures there that have been vetted and tested in the academic literature, and really tried to bring it into the current milieu. And so what we basically do is when it's a general orientation like this, you want to not rely on one question, because there could be something just kind of quirky in that one question. You want to build up a kind of composite measure from multiple statements so that they kind of give you more of a general orientation. Again, not just relying on people's reaction to one question. So I'll give you an example of some of the questions that we use. In this survey, we have a 4-question battery that we use to kind of construct what we call a right-wing authoritarianism scale. Again, it's drawing on a lot of academic literature. And actually, this literature was born out of the experience of fascism in World War II, right? So it begins in the 50s, following World War II, people trying to wrap their heads around, like, what happened here in Europe with the rise of fascism. And so these questions are things like this. What our country really needs is a strong, determined leader who will crush evil and take us back to our true path. Our country will be great if we honor the ways of our forefathers, do what the authorities tell us to do, and get rid of the rotten apples who are ruining everything. I'll give you just one more. The only way our country can get through the crisis ahead is to get back to our traditional values, put some tough leaders in power, and silence the troublemakers who are spreading bad ideas. So you can see here, there is a kind of conserving move here. There's a kind of apocalyptic appeal that this is kind of a special time where, you have to have a special strong man kind of leader here. And I should, strong man, I say that, that gender intentionally here. And this sense that there are people who are, out to undermine the country. And this leader is the one who's going to rally the country back to its greatness. Now, that all should sound pretty damn familiar to us in the current context, even though these questions were developed long before Donald Trump. And just essentially what we found is that if we then kind of categorize people into categories, one was a kind of very high score on this scale, a high score on this scale, a mixed score, a very low and a low score on the scale. And we paid a lot of attention to the kind of those very high and high scales here. And the partisan differences here are just really remarkable. It's about 4 in 10 Americans who fall into either the very high or high scale. But once you look at party, you can really see the difference here. So among Republicans, it is 67%. So fully 2/3 of Republicans who fall into that very high or high category. And this is a classic case of asymmetric polarization, which means that like independents are much closer to Democrats here. Republicans really are the outliers. So independents is 25% of independents and 28% of Democrats. And so it's very, very few compared to Republicans, but it is overwhelming. And you can also see the influence of Trump, even if you look at inside the Republican Party. It is really Republicans who have a favorable view of Trump. It's 75% of that group who fall in the higher, very high authoritarianism scale. Those who have an unfavorable view of Trump but are still Republican, it's only 39% compared to 75% of those who have a favorable view of Trump. So you can just see the influence even inside the Republican Party today.
One of the things that strikes me about the question is a little bit of surprise. Like, how could you answer yes to those? It's such a loaded question. It's not hard if you want to appear to be like a pro-American, pro-little d democracy. You're basically asking them if they want to wipe out people who don't agree with them. And yet you have these startling numbers. It's almost like there's no shame. There's no self-awareness. There's no compunction about doing that. Why do you think that frame of mind, not only this belief, but this utter shamelessness about it has existed? I'm not sure 20, 30 years ago, people would have admitted to wanting to wipe out their opponents. What's changed so?
Yeah, well, I think that's an astute observation. And you're right. I mean, these questions are not really that ambiguous, and again, we're not just measuring, one answer to those questions. We're kind of measuring answers to all four of those questions combined. So people have to, in order to get into that very high and high category, you basically have to agree with like all of them, right, in the same direction. So again, it's not just one question. It gives us a lot more confidence in the answer. But I think that one of the things that Trump has done is, there was a sense that before Trump that I think the country was coming along, and even people who were, for segregation, those kinds of things, against same-sex marriage, had the sense that like, okay, the country's moving in direction and we're going to kind of have to come along here. And I think one of the things that Trump has done is really ripped that off and said, no, actually we don't. We can go back here. And I think that, that make America great again. I mean, again, you and I've talked about this, but that last word, right, is the most powerful word in that slogan by far. It is this, again, we can go back to this thing that you feel like you've lost. And I think it has provided a kind of a permission structure. I mean, the rallies where all kinds of, again, like fascist things are being said at rallies, talking about immigrants poisoning the blood of our country. I mean, that is straight out of Mein Kampf.
Yes.
Right. And that's being said out loud, right, in campaign rallies. So I think that's kind of where we are, that there has been this And again, these are voluntary responses, you know, and we do ensure them with, you know, that they're, you know, everything's anonymous and they have privacy and all that. But again, these are people willing to say, yeah, that's what I think on a public opinion survey.
The contrast could not be greater, because what is the vice president's message? A new way forward.
Yeah.
So we have two completely different versions of America. And it doesn't seem to be, you would think, a new way forward, democracy, we need to be tolerant, that those would be 80% issues. But finding out there may be 55 or even 50%, or depending how you slice and dice the electorate, which is one reason why voter suppression and gerrymandering is so important to the Republicans, it's really close. And that's pretty startling for a lot of people.
Well, I would say this, I mean, a little caveat on that is that I do think what you said about, so why are we seeing such, you know, purging voter rolls, investigating people who are doing, you know, voter sign up and act, you know, kind of civic activism? Why is that happening? Voter ID laws. It is because the numbers really aren't there to support this vision. You know, so again, if we take, you know, it's 6 in 10 in the country who reject this kind of authoritarian view. If we look at Christian nationalism, it's 2 to 1 in the country that reject that view, even though it's a majority of Republicans and supermajority of white evangelical Protestants. So we're really not living in a 50-50 country, even if the presidential polls look like that. In terms of like what kind of principles do we elect or affirm, it's really more like a, you know, it's really almost a 2/3, 1/3 country. Like 2/3 of Americans support the rights to abortion. 2/3 of Americans today support the right of gay and lesbian people to legally marry. Like that's where we really are. Even on the things that we think about as kind of the most controversial issues in the country, 2/3 of the country reject these harsh characterizations of immigrants and harsh, you know, militarization of the border here. So these are minority views, but packaged up and sold right through, you know, they've kind of taken over one of our two political parties, which gives them that kind of outsized influence than they would have otherwise.
Exactly. We're not going to have a 65-35 election in November, which I think is what is disturbing to people. Let me go back to the survey itself. One of the things you can't tell is causation. Do people become Republicans because their religious worldview kind of encourages authoritarianism? Do authoritarian-minded people seek out a faith community that reflects that? Where is the beginning and where is the end in all of this?
Yes, is the answer.
Right.
you know, so it's complicated. And I think, you know, we can't really sort out all the causal vectors. But what we do know is that I think what we have is kind of, you want to think about this as a little bit of a feedback loop. And particularly when it does matter, when you have somebody at the top of the party, like Donald Trump, right, who is really precipitating a very particular take on these issues. And so that has certainly been an attraction for some. It's also been a repellent, right, for others, you know, in the party. So there has been a kind of sorting. And one of the things I'll say, too, is that it's worth remembering today. So, again, the country is becoming much more diverse religiously, racially. Again, kind of a good benchmark number. The country is only about 4 in 10, 41% white, non-Hispanic, and Christian, right? If you think about that as kind of the country's historic dominant kind of ethno-religious group, and that's no longer the case in the country. But the parties have kind of sorted themselves over the last really 40 years or so. And so today, even though the country is only 40% white and Christian, what's remarkable is that the Republican Party is 70% white and Christian. And so the Republican Party today looks about like 70-year-old America in terms of its race and religious upgrade. The Democratic Party today is only about 1/4 white and Christian. They look more like 18-year-old America. So our two parties are like really far apart in terms of just their kind of identities, sensibilities. And I think that's part of why it's so kind of visceral and the divides seem, I think, so intractable, but it is the, sort of the Democratic Party that like looks more like the future of the country. And the Republican Party really looks like it, again, it did in like the 1950s.
We just have to get through the next few decades and hope they don't destroy the democracy in the meantime. One of the other things that I found so interesting is the Christian nationalist element. That's a particular kind of domination that isn't just race. That's bringing back the supremacy of a religious tradition. And you measure things like this apocalyptic view that some of these rather extreme, frankly, Christian outlook on life. Talk to us a little bit about that and how you went about kind of measuring those factors and what that tells us, not only about the Republican Party, but about white Christianity these days.
Yeah. Well, you know, we also measure Christian nationalism with a complex scale like this right-wing authoritarianism scale. And we do it for the same reasons. We don't just want one question kind of reflecting it. So that that scale also has multiple questions built into it. And it's things like the country, we should declare the United States a Christian nation. U.S. law should be based on the Bible. If we move away from our Christian origins, we're not going to have a country anymore. We've kind of echoed some of the language that we're hearing. And it turns out that it's, again, it's only about 3 in 10 Americans who really lean into that or who are either Christian nationalism adherents or sympathizers here. But there's a big, big overlap between these authoritarian measures, like a 75% overlap. So if you think about this as kind of a stew, you know, the things in that stew that all kind of mix well together is this high views of authoritarianism, high views of Christian nationalism, high anti-immigrant attitudes. Like all of that is kind of, you know, in the mix together and all kind of correlating together. But we do have some specifics, I think, that'll kind of help, you know, bring some flavor out here that we did ask about a kind of apocalyptic views, because this is one thing that authoritarians use, right, to kind of get people to move away from the normal guardrails in society. Because if we're at this kind of special emergency time in the country, then extraordinary measures like breaking the rules, breaking the law, resorting to violence, these things can be justified, right? If we're in this kind of apocalyptic. So we, you know, to measure that, and you can see the overlap here. So we ask a question that, you know, do you agree or disagree? The final battle between good and evil is upon us, and Christians should stand firm with the full armor of God, right? A lot of kind of evangelical language there. And you look at the, again, the those who scored very high on the right-wing authoritarianism scale, 76% agree with that statement. The other one we hear a lot about, and this is kind of a group that Trump has really brought more to the fore, is a kind of Christian dominionist theology. And that is this idea that, and a theological idea, that Christians really should take over the country. It's often called the seven mountains of society, and the seven mountains are the government and business and media and entertainment and, you know, culture. And the Christians, that is the goal, for Christians to actually take over these things. And again, we look at among kind of those who score high on the right-wing authoritarianism scale, it's a majority who says that, who agree that God wants Christians to take control of the seven mountains of society. So we see this, these things kind of fit together, right? It makes sense. After all, I mean, there is no more stronger justification, right, for a kind of anti-democratic authoritarian movement than to say it's following God's will.
This is the equivalent of the Taliban in a Muslim country, that you do it or you get out of the way because there's not room for people who are essentially dissenters. One of the things that I found so interesting, both about your original book and the current data, is I don't see a strong, I call it a Reformation movement within white Christian churches. Is there one that is pushing back against this, that is troubled by this? Are there communities, are there organizations that are saying, we have to figure out how Christian evangelicals operate in a pluralistic country, because that's the country we're in?
Now, that's right. And yes, so the answer is yes, there are. It's interesting, though, we talk a lot about white evangelicals, and we should, because they are the group that's most impacted by this. Again, you know, two-thirds of them identify as either Christian nationalists, sympathizers, or adherents. Two-thirds of them score high on the authoritarianism scale. They vote for Trump in overwhelming numbers, you know, 85% in the last election. So, I mean, they're all in, right, for the kind of MAGA authoritarian movement here. So we should be talking about them. But it's worth remembering they're only one piece of the white Christian world, right? In fact, they only make up 13% of the country. They're the non-evangelical white Protestants actually make up, they're just as large. They make up 13% of the country. They still lean toward Trump, but not, like, they voted about 60% for Trump. They score much less high on the Christian nationalism scale and less high on the authoritarianism scale as well. So it's worth remembering, like, there is some diversity, I think, within the white Christian movement. But to be very specific, I mean, there's a whole range of books out, about this. I mean, my book is just one of a number out there. And there are movements. So, you know, there is a movement put out by the Baptist Joint Committee, which is kind of a group that came out of the Southern Baptist world historically, called Christians Against Christian Nationalism, that has, you know, tens of thousands of kind of signatories on a kind of statement opposing Christian nationalism. And so there are movements like that, but I think they are just not as well funded. They're certainly not as visible, and they certainly don't, and they don't have that kind of, like, you know, a front candidate like Trump, like, really bringing it to the fore. So they are a kind of resistance movement. I mean, I think the good news is most of the country, and it's also worth noting that this is a white Christian problem we're talking about. It is much less prominent among Christians of color, particularly African-American Protestants, who are nowhere really in supporting Trump. They're overwhelmingly supporting Democratic candidates historically and continue to do so for the most part today.
Prescription products require completion of an online medication consultation with an independent healthcare provider through the LifeMD platform and are only available if prescribed. Subscription required. Individual results may vary. Additional restrictions apply at LifeMD.com. Read all warnings before using GLP-1s. Side effects may include a risk of thyroid C-cell tumors. Do not use GLP-1s if you or your family have a history of thyroid cancer.
Confused on where to start with weight loss medication? See the lowest prices available with or without insurance for Wegovy, Zepbound, and more at TryLifeMD.com. 95% of LifeMD patients said starting their weight loss journey was simple. Listen to Tara's story after losing 42 pounds.
You just take your shot. It doesn't feel like you're on a diet. What I wasn't expecting it to do was to shut off the food noise. I had gone from 237 to 195. This was life-altering, and if I can do it, I feel like anybody can do it.
Get your free insurance benefits check in minutes right now at TryLifeMD.com. Nearly 96% of patients said they would recommend the LifeMD program to anyone who wants to lose weight. Get started right now at TryLifeMD.com. That's TryLifeMD.com.
This is an ad by BetterHelp. Workplace stress is now a leading cause of declining mental health, with 61% of the global workforce feeling it more than ever. You can't escape work, but you can take small steps to take care of yourself. A walk, some sun, a favorite song. Therapy is one of those steps. Ongoing support to build resilience for whatever your day throws at you. Balance is tough. Getting help shouldn't be. Visit BetterHelp.com today to get 10% off your first month.
What can be done, I guess, is the easiest way. You know, in the political realm, you can organize, you can go out and vote. But if you're an ordinary American living in a geographic area in which there are a lot of these people, what do you do? What are the ways in which, even on an individual level or civic level, you can kind of make some progress, get some traction to show people that we can't go down this road, that that's not what America is about?
Well, you know, in the book, I went looking for some answers to that question, right? Because I was thinking the same thing, like, what can be done? And so in the book, I spent some time in three communities, in the Delta of Mississippi, in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and in Duluth, Minnesota. Now, none of these places are bastions of liberalism, right? So, Oklahoma is, I think, the only state that has a distinction that every county voted for Trump in both 2016 and in 2020. Mississippi is also a bright red state with a horrific track record on many of these issues. It's my home state, where I grew up. And what I found, though, is like on the ground, there are actually like some very courageous work being done on the ground, like in Mississippi, to tell the truth about the story of Emmett Till. In Mississippi, in Oklahoma, to tell the truth, not only about the kind of horrific things that happened to the Osage indigenous people that Killers of the Flower Moon, the book and the movie told that story, also the Tulsa race massacre that we just had the 100th centennial at, and even in Duluth, all right, kind of telling the truth about places when we have gone down the wrong road, right? When there was a lynching and 10,000 white Christian people turned out in Duluth, Minnesota, not Alabama, Minnesota, to witness and support this lynching. And so what do we do with that history? How do we tell this history? How do we move toward ways that basically like say, no, never again. We know what happens when we go down this road and we're not going there again. There's a lot of courageous work done even in unlikely places like Oklahoma, Mississippi, and like Duluth being done to kind of inoculate us and kind of remind us. But I think it's a process of truth-telling and repair. I think and there are these movements being done, again, in surprising places around the country. That gives me some hope.
And one thing I'm struck by, both in your book and some of the travels that I've made around the country, is the importance of a physical commemoration, a physical memorial, something that represents concrete people. It makes, I think, it very difficult or more difficult to kind of shove this stuff out of the way. The fight over the conservative monuments, that has real meaning because it says who we are. It's a way you can't get away from it. You see it every day. People ask questions about it. And one thing I will say that President Biden has done is he's done some of that. He has made, raised awareness about the Tulsa race massacre, for example. What are ways that people can work in their own community? In other words, you went to these three different places, sometimes contentious, sometimes difficult, but people kind of figured out a way to work together. What did you learn from that? What are the best ways for people to interact? And what are some things that they should avoid doing when they get together and attempt to have some kind of reconciliation?
Yeah. Well, I'll maybe give an example from Mississippi. It's kind of one, again, kind of my own home state. So, in the Delta of Mississippi, as late as like the year 2000, if you had driven through the Delta, there was not a single local marker, monument telling the story of Emmett Till. There was a memorial highway dedicated to the racist sheriff who was infamous for using the N-word every day in court and even segregating the courtroom during the trial. But there was nothing for Emmett Till, and basically, it started. So I would say, like, one thing is like start local, start small. And that effort began with a handful of citizens, local citizens, and like this is a rural county, right? Sumner, Mississippi, the county seat has like 600 people in it. Like, it's a small place. But they said, they started like, we have never issued an apology for what happened to Emmett Till, and we want to just issue an apology to the Till family. And that's where it started. And so they began to gather people, black and white. They knew it had to be a kind of not just, white people or black people, but a biracial group in that context to do this well. They began to meet. And as they began to meet, they began to realize, like, yes, we're going to do that. And they did that. And that was a fight in itself. I mean, that was a complex set of things that had to get negotiated. But then they went on to say, like, and we need now to figure out how we tell this story, not just apologize, but tell the story. We mark it. So they began to raise money for some memorials, some markers, some signs. You may have seen the news got shot up that were off by the highway. Like, white supremacists would come by and just literally shoot holes in the signs. They put another sign up and they kind of kept at it. And that movement has built now to where there is a new national monument that's going to be managed by the National Park Service. It's going to be jointly held in the Mississippi Delta up and in Chicago. So it's the Mamie Till and Emmett Till memorial that's going to be there. And like none of them would have dreamed that kind of work would have happened when they first sat down. But when they dedicated themselves to telling truth and to kind of trying to repair the damage that had been done in the interest of building a different kind of future for the people who lived in that community, that's, I think, where the power came from. And it really took on a life of its own.
I thought those stories were so powerful because they really had resonance and they paid off in Duluth. For example, when we had the killing of a terrible killing of George Floyd, the community yeah. didn't explode. It didn't erupt into violence. As we reach the end of our time, I want to ask you two questions. First, what's the reaction when you go around the country? What do you hear from people? Do you get a lot of pushback? Do you get people who say, oh, you're a traitor to your religion, or what are you doing, man? Or, you know, why are you telling all this bad stuff? What's been kind of the range of reaction?
It's been a range. You know, so I do try to say yes to as many opportunities to speak in the South, you know, and to speak in Christian spaces. So, you know, I've spoken at a Nazarene seminary, at Baptist colleges, you know, at churches. I've probably been in 120 churches over the last 3 years.
Wow.
Predominantly white congregations. And, you know, I've had, I think, only two that got canceled.
Because when you figured out what the book was about, yeah.
There was an outroar or uproar about, you know, the book. And the book has the word white supremacy in the title, right? So, and it's been, I think, for me, like, notable that, like, you know, I'll show up to a white church and they will have a notice about, like, you know, on the church marquee out in the front lawn, it'll say, you know, the hidden roots of white supremacy. And just to have the words white supremacy show up in a predominantly white church marquee sitting out in the public lawn, that's actually something that even 10, 15 years ago would have been pretty tough. And I think there's more of an openness to having those conversations. And I think that's been kind of heartening, you know, and for people having challenging conversations, like, are we going to talk about the white Jesus that's in the stained glass windows, right, of our church and what that means? And what should we do about it? I mean, and should we have a serious theological conversation about that and where we want to go? What kind of a congregation do we want to be? What does that say about us? And there are those kind of hard conversations going on, again, that I think are give me some hope on the ground.
That is hopeful. So where do you go from here? What's your next project or what's your next sort of goal if you have them? Obviously, you have the new paperback out that you want to promote. But do you have another book in mind? Do you have another topic in mind? Where are you going on this journey?
You're really timely. I've just kind of drafted something. And I, we mentioned 2026 earlier about the 250th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence, where we're going to have, you know, a whole year's worth of events where we think about who we are, who we want to be. It's, you know, I was in third grade during the bicentennial, you know, and I remember that well. Like, there were events at school. There were, you know, all kinds of reflections on the country at that state. And so the next project, I think, is going to lean into that moment and to kind of think about the ideas I'm playing around with are, you know, the promises of the country, right? And then the ways that the word America in particular has often been captured and restricted to really mean one racial group, one religious group that has pride of place when the word America gets used. And so what would it mean to kind of open that up and like fully embrace a more pluralistic view of America that could then be more consistent with kind of our broader principles? So that's where I'm going, I think, in the next book.
That is fascinating. And I must say, you really don't tackle the easy questions, do you, Robert? You really go for the gold, you know?
Well, I mean, I think like you and most of us who care about the country, I mean, I'm struggling, right?
Yeah.
And struggling to make sense of it and struggling to get through it. And so part of what writing does for me is, you know, I often try to just write the book I need to read because that's just where my head and my heart is at the end of the day.
Exactly. As I like to say, it's cheaper than therapy.
That's right.
thank you so much, Robert, for coming back. I always love our conversations. You have so informed my view of Christianity, of America, of our history. It's always, always a delight to see you. So good luck with the paperback, and hopefully before then, but certainly when you come back with your new book, we'll have you back and talk about the Declaration.
Oh, thanks so much. And always, yeah, lovely to talk with you. So thanks for having me on.
My pleasure. And that was Robert P. Jones. Wow. I come away with very conflicting emotions after that conversation. On one hand, it's frightening. It is frightening that so many Americans reject the essential fundamental premise of the country. After all, we're founded on the principle that all men are created equal. We're founded on religious liberty. We're founded on the rule of law. And when a large segment of the population rejects that, and when they entirely capture one political party, then the essence of America really is in danger. And that's kind of where we are right now. And as Robert said, we can't really negotiate with that. It's like negotiating with the Taliban. When you're talking about religious fundamentalists, they're not going to give you half a loaf. They're not going to get along. Their entire view is, as he said, to capture these various aspects of society. And one of them is capturing the government. And that's what this is all about. And that's why it's so frightful and why it's so critical that people wake up and get themselves engaged in our political system. Now, on the other hand, what does give me hope is, as he said, his experience on the ground, that there are people of goodwill in communities that you wouldn't necessarily think of as bastions of tolerance and progressivism, that nevertheless are working on these problems. They're dealing with their neighbors. They're going back to ask hard questions about their own communities. And I come back to this a lot because I think when we nationalize these issues and get the national media and the national advocacy groups involved, it automatically becomes harder, more emotional, more uncivil, more violent in some cases. But if you can retreat, if you will, if you can back up and bring it down even below the state level, to the city level, to the community level, to the church level, you will see that a lot of good things are going on. That's what this movement of universities to go back and look at their attachment and their dependence on slavery is all about. That's about coming to a recollection and a resolution of their past. And when you do that, then you can resolve current divides. And that's what coming up with a memorial for Emmett Till or for a horrendous tragedy that occurred in Duluth or for really any racial event and calamity provides you with. That it's an opportunity, it is a learning moment. And I come back to President Biden elevating the Tulsa race massacre. I never learned about that in school. And learning about that as an adult is extremely meaningful. And it's also angering. Why wasn't I provided with that history? And so all of us, I think, have an obligation to go back and to see what we know and what we don't know. And that's why the MAGA group, by the way, is so keen on censoring books, censoring history, because they don't want us to understand what America's past has been. And that's why they have to be resisted. That's why it's just as important that you run for school board as you do volunteer for a national campaign. Because we're talking about preserving truth. We're talking about preserving the essence of democracy. So, as with most things, the glass is either half full or half empty or both, yes. So we go forward and we do our best to, on a local level, be kind, be decent, help reconstruct rather than obliterate our history, and on a national level, push us forward, as Kamala Harris says, a new way forward. Wouldn't that be nice? Well, thanks so much for joining us again. Let me know what you think. Particularly on this issue, I really want to hear your comments and questions, and remind your friends where they can find us, which is anywhere they get their podcasts. We'll see you next time. Bye-bye.